For Toms or Timo, who is a PhD student at Princeton University, who has done a lot of work in the area of truth commissions and transitional justice, who will chair the panel.
Thank you, Phil. It's not actually true that I have done a lot of work, but I've done some work that seemed to strike a nerve. Good afternoon. Thank you to Phil Oxhorn and to ICID for inviting me to be part of a group of such extraordinary people. It's my pleasure to introduce this final panel to you, and you'll see in the next few minutes why I think it actually was a good fit for me to introduce this panel. But first I want to just say briefly, if you've looked at the schedule for today and you saw the title of our session, which was Experiences Without TRC, and you looked at the cases, you may have been puzzled, and you weren't wrong. Kenya, in fact, had a truth commission from 2008 until 2013, although there has been much dissatisfaction with the process. And Uruguay also has had a truth commission, depending on how you define truth commissions. And I'm sure that our two panelists will give us some more detail on this. And also talk to us about the shortcomings of these truth-telling exercises. And even the third case that we had included on this agenda, Rwanda had experiences with truth-telling in its local Gacaca trials. But this was a very different setting than a TRC, obviously. Unfortunately, our Rwandan delegate, Anastase Shiaka, was not able to make it to the meeting today. So that gives us a bit more time to for our presenters and for questions at the end. So we've heard much about individual cases of truth commissions in the last couple of days. And before introducing our panelists, I would like to give you a brief primer on the comparative social science of transitional justice, because I think that this will underscore the importance of looking at cases such as Kenya and Uruguay for a better understanding of what TRCs can accomplish and under what conditions. So my own background in this is that a few years ago, my co-authors, James Ron and Roland Paris, we were interested in the state-level effects of transitional justice policies, and we wrote a very long review of comparative scholarship on the impacts of truth commissions and trials, human rights trials. And what struck us at the time was that aside from very strong moral and legal rationales for these policies, we often heard causal claims about what transitional justice policies could accomplish. And some of these, some of this discussion was nicely foreshadowed today by some of the questions from the audience, actually, especially during our panel on the trendsetters. So, just to give a quick recap on that, some proponents suggested that transitional justice policies would promote psychological healing, peace, and possibly reconciliation. And we've already problematized that term, reconciliation, today. Improvements in respect for human rights. And important for our discussion today, that it helps establish conditions for democratic governance, kind of broadly defined. Now, with respect to truth commissions, the expectations were that they would provide an official acknowledgement of abuses, rewrite history by focusing on the institutional and structural factors that permitted the abuses, encourage recommendations for institutional reform, and perhaps even provide background for later prosecutions and vetting or illustration exercises. And provide a basis, possibly, for reparations and memorialization. And finally, help with individual healing and reconciliation, as I said before, thereby breaking the cycle of revenge and hatred between former enemies. So these are sort of some of the ideas, these causal ideas that were out there. On the other hand, there were transitional justice skeptics who believed that trials and truth commissions could sharpen societal divisions, undermine peace settlements in ongoing conflicts, and even provoke backlash by spoilers. because establishing a record of past abuses could generate further resentment from both victims and perpetrators alike. Moreover, some skeptics argued that truth commissions could in fact provide smoke screens to deflect attention away from continuing abuses. And I think we've heard sort of that idea has been in the background today a little bit. So what my co-authors and I did was we looked at all the available comparative research at the time that we could find and considered the effects of trials and of truth commissions on personal integrity rights, so a subset of human rights, on political violence, on rule of law, and what you might call a culture of human rights, and finally on democratization. So what we found is that this literature is really still in its infancy, even though it's rapidly maturing and growing. Most research was based on single case studies rather than structured comparisons, based on a few very well-documented cases, mostly in Latin America, where it was not always clear to what extent the findings would travel to other contexts, especially once there were truth commissions in post-conflict transitions rather than democratic transitions. Also, there were very few studies that rigorously tried to assess alternative causal explanations for post-transitional justice outcomes, or that compare transitional justice experiences to democratic or post-conflict transitions without such policies. So basically what I'm saying is, in other words, there were very few analyses of negative cases. Studies also tended to examine short-term outcomes rather than long-term change, which makes sense because not that much time has yet passed. So there was often a focus on the degree to which a commission completed its objectives within the assigned period. Very few studies focused on more than one transitional justice mechanism in order to understand interactions or a sequencing between different policies. And as is perhaps not surprising for a young field of scholarship, we found that there were a lot of contradictory findings. And let me give you some examples of this. On the relationship with democratization, there are studies that found no systematic associations with either the extent of democracy or the functioning of democracy or with processes of democratization. Or there were also studies that found positive associations with democratization in cross-national samples. Now, when studies dig a bit deeper, they find that truth commissions themselves have little discernible effects on democratization, but that forward-looking institutional reforms, such as of the police, the judiciary, the military, are much more consistently linked to democratization, at least in statistical studies. The lesson here seems to be that truth commissions can help move along democratization if they help discredit previously unaccountable institutions. Now, more worryingly, quite a few studies find that the presence of truth commissions is negatively associated with subsequent respect for personal integrity rights. And this has come up again and again in studies. Only in combination with other transitional justice policies, such as trials or partial amnesties, are truth commissions associated with better human rights practices after the completion of the truth commission. So we concluded from this review that while many of the state-level impacts of transitional justice policies were still unclear, the good news is that the worst fears of skeptics do not seem to be supported, although we do need to better understand the negative findings on human rights. Interestingly, I'm not very familiar with the psychological literature, but I just read a review article with sort of the same idea as ours, just on the individual level, just the other day. And this article came to very similar conclusions, that there's really no good evidence that truth-telling either satisfies victims' needs for justice systematically, or eases emotional and psychological suffering, or dampens desires for vengeance, but that there's also no good evidence that truth-telling systematically causes additional psychological harms in addition to the violations in the first place. So what might account for some of the contradictions? There's disagreement on the universe of cases. Some studies look at only democratic transitions, others at post-conflict transitions, and others try to include as many countries as they can, given the data. The scope conditions are often unclear. Few studies consciously consider how transitional justice policies are embedded in wider peace-building policies. So there's a real need to consider interactions with other dimensions of transitions in future research. There are also significant data limitations on some of the outcomes that people look at in this research. For instance, existing cross-national measures of human rights are far from ideal. And there are almost no analyses of the variation in implementation of truth commissions, which is kind of a glaring gap. But just in the last year, some research has been coming out that looks at the publicness of truth commissions. It's still somewhat roughly measured, but it's a step in the right direction. But we still don't know enough about what accounts for the implementation of truth commissions' recommendations. And of particular interest to this conference, and I'll come to an end now, there has been very little conceptualization of democratic governance in this literature, beyond looking at the implications of how judiciaries deal with perpetrators. So it'll be very interesting to hear how our panelists see the democratic implications of truth-telling efforts in their cases. So let me introduce the panelists. And I'll introduce both of them right now. First up is Aldo Marchesi, who teaches history at the Universidad de la República in Montevideo. He has published widely on the recent history and collective memory of the Southern Cone, especially Uruguay. He received his PhD a couple years ago from New York University, and he's currently turning his dissertation titled Geographies of Armed Protest, Transnational Cold War, Latin American Internationalism, and the New Left in the Southern Cone from 1966 to 1976 into a book. And Njonjo Mue is a human rights lawyer and an advocate of the High Court of Kenya. He has much experience and expertise in the transitional justice field. He is a program advisor to Kenyans for Peace, Truth, and Justice. He had served previously as the Deputy Director for Africa and head of the Kenya Office of the International Center for Transitional Justice, the premier global NGO working on transitional justice. And he had worked as the head of advocacy of the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. He's also served as the legal advisor to the Africa Program of the Freedom of Expression Watchdog, Article 19, and he was the regional director of PANOS Eastern Africa. And finally, in 2000, he was named the Jurist of the Year by the Kenya section of the International Commission of Jurists for his work on democracy, human rights, and rule of law promotion.
Good afternoon. First, I would like to thank Philip and also Monica and Jan for their invitation to this conference. It's a real good opportunity to have this kind of conversation between very different experience of truth commissions and transitional justice. And for me especially, it was a really good chance to know the experience in Canada that I have to confess I don't have too much idea what was happening here. So really thank you. It was a real pleasure to be here. First, I would like to explain the title of my presentation. And the title came from an initial misunderstanding that we have in our conversation with Philippe, that Tino talked a bit about that. I was invited to a session that was titled Experience Without truth commissions, and I wrote to Philippe saying, "No, in Uruguay there were at least two truth commissions during this century." And well, we have a really good conversation by mails, but it made me think about how we use the words in this kind of transnational field called transitional justice. And it made me think a lot about the tension between the uses of concept in a kind of universal way that sometimes means very different things in very different places. No? We tend to assume that justice, reconciliation, and truth means kind of universal values, but when we go to different places, we see that means very different things. I thought that this presentation could be an opportunity to try to give a kind of local flavor of the uses of these three concepts, no? Truth, justice, and reconciliation in the specific case that was Uruguay. Well, this is the reason of the title. So I will begin. If this works. It's not working. No, it's okay. Okay. I choose a picture to introduce, to give a brief introduction about the history of Uruguay. Uruguay suffered a dictatorship between 1973 to 1985. It was a very cruel authoritarian regime, and it was marked by the experience of political prison. Here you have a prison that has a very kind of cynical or paradoxical name. The prison, the name of the prison is Liberty. It was designed by militaries in 1972. It was a prison specifically thought for political prisoners. It was designed according to the most modern standards of control and surveillance, but also have specific places to increase the suffering of people. I mean, there are some floors that have very small cells without light, without air, called islands, that were thought to as a way of torture. No? This is a kind of very emblematic building and represents as a sort of lieu of memory, of memoir, a very representative evidence of experience of torture and political prison. And this was one of the characteristics of the dictatorship in Uruguay. While in Argentina, the dictatorship, its main method of repression was disappearance. In Uruguay, the main method of repression was jail. We had 7,000 political prisoners in a country that has 3 million people. We have extended methods of torture in prison during that period. Also, they were disappeared. Most of them were outside Uruguay in the exile. We have a huge amount of people who went into exile during that period. Before to begin with the transition, I would like to emphasize the specific character of this dictatorship. Authoritarian regime that could be characterized like a conservative reaction against social movement and leftist political parties from the 70s, from the 60s and the 70s. And the main issues at stake at that moment were issues related to wealth redistribution, no? Were social and economical issues in a context of crisis in Uruguay. I think that this is very important to try to understand the different approaches, that different kind of experience. I mean, we are not talking here about a civil war. We are not talking here about an ethnic conflict. We are talking mainly about a conflict that was social and ideological, because it was fueled by the Cold War rhetoric of that time. No? Well, so in 1985, you have a restoration of democracy. It was a negotiated democracy. It was the result of an agreement between civilians and militaries. It was a negotiated transition. So the beginning of the democracy shows a kind of shows certain levels of fragility. Even Uruguay had a long tradition of democracy in the context of Latin America. One of the first laws that the government passed was the amnesty for political prisoners. No? There were around 7,000 people that in 1985 still were in jail. So they were liberated as one of the first acts of the democratic government. This amnesty has a very strong support. I mean, people from the center, even people from the right, even some people who support the dictatorship, and obviously people from the left, support the amnesty law. But then we came to another issue that was a more controversial, debatable issue, that was what we have to do with the military. How to deal with an institution that still had power at that moment, but that had a lot of responsibilities related to the crimes committed during the dictatorship. The solution that the government found was an amnesty law. No? It was an amnesty law to defend members of the army accused of committing political crime during the dictatorship. The law has a very specific name that is important to try to show the specific features of this amnesty. Ley de caducidad de la pretensión punitiva del Estado, law on the expiry of the punitive claims of the state. What does it mean? It means that there is a kind of amnesty in advance. It's an amnesty without trials. It's an amnesty without judge. Without justice. For example, if you see in South Africa, there were some hearings and then start the process of amnesty. Here, the army didn't have to go to court. No? So there was any chance for truth at the beginning. The army don't have to be, don't receive any kind of pressure to say what they did during the dictatorship. There were two kind of arguments in favor of this law. The first argument was stability. That is a very common argument in the 80s in South America. You have very fragile democracies, you have armies that still have a lot of power, you can't confront with these armies. It was considered a law to prevent institutional risks. No? Because what could happen in Uruguay is that the judicial power asked for the militaries to go to court, and the militaries, it was thought that they wouldn't go to courts. No? And so the possible scenario would be a kind of institutional crisis. So we have to prevent this institutional crisis. The second argument was reconciliation. And it was presented and it's a kind of rhetorical that happened in many countries in Latin America, especially in South America, as kind of amnesty to cover both sides of the conflict. No? So the government at the beginning gave an amnesty for the political prisoners, around 6,000 people who suffered during 12 years torture, extreme pain, blah, 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 blah. And now we give amnesty to the members of the army who committed crime, but they don't receive any kind of punishment. So there is a kind of amnesty that is very unequal in the ways in which treat both sides of the conflict. No? But it was the way in which was framed the argument. And the argument, it was very close to the idea of reconciliation. The supporters of this argument about the amnesty use the word reconciliation, and the word reconciliation was explicitly used as synonymous of silence, forget, and also as opposite of justice. No? Reconciliation is possible because there is no justice. And in their point of view, reconciliation was a very good thing, a necessary thing, but it was also a way to cancel the past, close the past, and not talk about the past. For this reason, I think that the word reconciliation in Uruguay don't have good press. Even then, in the 90s or in the 20th century, the people, the social movement, the human rights groups are not very accustomed to this word. They don't use it. And sometimes the church has tried to use it, but it didn't work very well, among other reasons, because Uruguay is a very secularized society and church don't count too much in the political debate. But this is the first thing that I would like to say, that the word reconciliation it was very related to one of the political actors in during this period. And the word reconciliation was not a word that could create kind of consensus. On the contrary, it creates more conflict. The reaction against the law was an intense and heated reaction. Mainly was directed by social movements, student, worker, human rights organizations, left parties, but also group of the traditional political parties related to the center and to the center spectrum. And this front of social movement who were against the law belong to the experience of the transition to democracy. I mean, there is a kind of continuation between the experience of transition and the debate about the law. And for these groups, this law meant a kind of triation to the democratic transition. It was a kind of wrong direction in order to create a new democracy. No? This was the argument of the social movement. The idea of amnesty or of militaries is an argument against democracy. No? This social movement promotes two attempts to revoke the law through popular consultation. In the Uruguayan constitution, you have the chance to demand popular consultations through very different means. And there were two attempts. The first one was in 1989, the second one was in 2009. And in both, most of the population support the amnesty law. And this is a very controversial, interesting, problematic debate within Uruguay. I mean, we are one of the few countries in the world that where the amnesty of dictatorship was supported by popular willing. No? This is the reason why the majority of the vote went to the support of the law, still we need to do a lot of study about that, but there are two main reasons. One is that many people bought the strategy of the government. They saw that they don't want to talk about the past, that the past could be a risky scenario if we start to talk against again about the past. And the second reason was kind of fear about a possible scenario of return to dictatorship. Still, if you see, there is a difference of 20 years between both popular consultations, and the margin of people who are against the law was growing. The last one was in 2009, and almost half of the population was against the law. Also, there were attempts to revoke the amnesty law by the legislative power, especially during the last two administrations. There was an attempt to pass a new law to revoke the old law, but this attempt was denegated by the Supreme Court for inconstitutionality. So, what happened in Uruguay with the notion of justice? First, during that period, the human rights organizations saw a very limited notion of justice. And this limited notion of justice was limited at least for three issues that I try to show here. The first, by law. The law only allow some kind of exceptions that allow that 20 perpetrators are in jail, but mainly due to legal loopholes of the law, like civilians who participate in the repression, militaries who prosecuted victims in neighbor countries, not in Uruguay. No? So through these loopholes, it was possible put 20 perpetrators in jail. But most of the members of the army who participate in this repression are still living a normal life. But justice also was limited by popular sovereignty. No? And this is a very interesting point, because you have here attention about the two notions that are part of the idea of democracy. On the one hand, you have popular sovereignty. On the other hand, you have justice. Two are clear democratic values in terms of how you think a democratic community. And this was a very present tension between these two values and what you have to choose. And you see in the debate during the last years this tension in a very dramatic way. Last, justice was limited by the expiration of the crimes. No? According to the Uruguayan law, I'm not a lawyer, I'm very bad about these things, but a crime expires after 25 years of happening, if there is any kind of judicial process around that. In this case, many cases expired. So, in this context of limited justice, it's that the word truth took another level of meaning. Because truth means for social movement a kind of new chance to have something. If you can't have justice, well, let's try with truth at least. And there is a reemergence of social movement in the 90s. There is a specific movement related to a demonstration that every year happened on May 20. that is the Marcha del Silencio, Demonstration of Silence. And it has a very specific question that is about the truth and about the truth of the disappeared. You have the pancarta, you know. And it's, where are they? They are talking about the disappeared, and the truth still is kidnapped. Never again state terrorism. So the question of the social movement, or the demand of the social movement, was about what happened with the bodies of the disappeared people. This was the new agenda in the 90s. But truth was conceived as a possibility, because there was a very chance, a limited chance of justice. In the turn of the century, in the new century, the new government had a new approach. During the 80s and 90s, governments, they really don't care about the demand of the social movement. But there were the first two governments during the century recognized the demand of truth. A truth that is without justice, or with a limited possibilities of justice. In this context, was that there were two commissions of truth. The first was during the Bashar administration, that is a rightist center political party, the Partido Colorado. And the second one was during the Vasquez administration, that it was a new kind of government. You know why? It was the first time that the left won the government. Both had many continuities. Maybe the main difference is that the second report was first written by historians, not written by honorable people. The first commission followed the kind of idea that the commission has to be honorable people, like people with some kind of public recognition. In the second one, there was another kind of strategy. There were the government asked to the university to do a report with their better historians. Maybe this is the main difference. In the second important difference is that in the second government, this commission have access to the state records, even the many records that were closed until this moment. So I would like to refer to the ways in how truth was understood in this process. The first thing is this idea of truth as a negotiation. No? Truth is not the goal of the social movement. Truth is also not the goal of the government. It's the result of a negotiation. It's a possibility that try to solve a problem. There is any kind of moral goal behind truth in terms of how we conceive truth. Truth also was related to the fate of disappeared. No? The thing that I say two slides ago. The demand is very related to the disappeared, but there was not much debate about torture, about political prisoners, and it's striking because in Uruguay, one of the main characters of the repression was the political prison. However, in the debate, there was not much debate about that. Third, the notion of truth was legal, not historical. What I mean by this? I think many people here talk about a bit about this. The notion of truth that the state depicted in these reports is a notion associated with the idea of crime. No, they report about a crime. They report about a disappear, about a killing. But they don't give any kind of context about how this crime was committed, about which are the political and economical and historical conditions in which this repression happened. If you think in terms of pedagogy of memory, you can make a show that is, if a child is hearing about all this stuff, maybe could think that there is any kind of historical explanation, no? There is any kind of connection with the historical process in which this crimes happen. So, the notion of truth enabled the recognition by the state of the atrocities committed by the dictatorship and helped to learn how to deal with political conflict in democracy. This is very clear. Uruguay has a very strong democracy. We have freedom of expression. We have alternance in the government. We have transparent elections. We don't have any kind of political prisoners or any kind of political prosecution. We have had during this period center-leftist government. We have had rightist government, and there was alternance. So the democracy in red as a political institution is working very well. But the point is, and the ways in which the past was read, it helped to reinforce these ideas of political democracy. But on the other hand, you can say that this idea of truth helped to narrow and enclose the idea of human rights. In the public debate, there is a constant distinction between the human right of the past and human right of the present. As a result of the economic crisis that we have to face at the beginning of this century, we are now facing a rise in the numbers of criminality. We again, for other reasons, are scoring in the highest level of prisoners in Latin America. But now these prisoners are not like the prisoners of the past, are young people. But the other prisoners also were young, but these prisoners came from other parts of our society, most poor people. That are suffering really abuses, serious abuses of human rights. No? However, there is any kind of public debate about that. Just to show a picture that is representative of this is a building that where a prison. I think that it's a nice picture because it depicts the kind of identity of these prisoners. These new prisoners are young people. Some of them they have the flag of their soccer teams in the cells, but in each cell there are around 10 people in cells that are thought for 3 people. No? So there is a kind of continuity or coincidence between the way in which political prisoners were treated and regular prisoners right now are treated. However, there is any kind of realization about this fact. No? There is another coincidence that this building is the same building that I showed you at the beginning. This is the Freedom Prison. What was intolerable to political prisoners right now is uses for prisoners. And this was, I insist, this is not a public debate in Uruguay about that. Just one guy who came from outside realized about that. Manfred Novak, a human rights reporter, in a human rights reporter in Uruguay in 2009, he said, well, here you have, Liberty Penitentiary was an infamous symbol of torture and ill-treatment during the military dictatorship. And 20 years later, with a democratic government in place, it is renowned for its subhuman condition, in clear contravention of international standards. This is my last point, that sometimes truth helps to improve democracy, to improve human rights, but sometimes it has some kind of perverse impact. I think that here we are, in Uruguay, we are in this tension, no? And made me think a lot about another idea that has been very present in this debate, that is the idea of never again, no? The idea of that the kind of remembering of this experience could help to avoid any kind of repetition. The point is, if it is really true, on how this idea works in the specific local historical experience. Just this. Thank you very much.